Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Connecting Faith. Today we have in studio Bill Arnold and George Fraser, hosts of Real Recovery, Sundays at 5, sitting in for our friend Neil Stavem, who is, I believe, in town, but just can't be here today. So we're glad you joined us, and welcome to your lunch hour. If you're spending your lunch hour listening to us, we're very glad you've joined us because we've got a very fascinating guest we're going to be bringing on in just a few minutes. We have today on the program Ed Moy, who from 2006 to 2011, he served as the 38th director of the United States Mint. George, your comment on that?
Nice.
No kidding.
Well, the rest of his resume is great, too.
I know. He's very smart. He has got a lot of education, a lot of work experience. He's a businessman. He's a Christian. He knows a lot of stuff. He's going to be a great guest.
He's a successful Christian businessman who went to Washington, who served his country. He knows the healthcare business. I think it's going to be a fascinating hour.
Well, George, I don't know about you, and you know, the whole idea of gold has come to the front and center with the Olympics on, because I watched people get their gold medals, and of course, we're always reminded of the value of gold. And I don't know if you invest in gold or have gold. I know personally, my investment strategy is, I have my money in mayonnaise jars underneath my bed. And then every time I pull open the shades, I can hear Washington and Lincoln going, "Hey, knock it off. Natural light, get it off us." So that's my investment strategy.
Solid, Bill.
And well, it is solid. But I did try a gold investment last year. I did get a gold crown in my mouth. So
that's
where I'm at with my gold investment.
Probably paid too much.
I probably did. But I think the value is increasing.
Depends on how long you're around, I think.
But we're going to have a fascinating conversation with our guest today, Ed Moy. He lives in Seattle, and he recently returned from a trip. He was on a whirlwind trip. He was in Washington, D.C. He was in New York City. He was in Paris. He was in London. And in my opinion, he must be jet lagged. But he's joining us today from his home in Seattle. And welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill. George, good to be with both of you guys. And, you know, that great introduction is not going to get you any free samples from the Mint today.
That was going to be my next question. So, Ryan, why don't we go to commercial? Because we got some time to kill now.
No, you
got
to talk to him.
All right. So, you know, your resume is fascinating. And, you know, when you were appointed director of the U.S. Mint in 2006, and you were appointed by George Bush, is that right?
That's correct.
All right. What is that sensation like of being in charge now of Fort Knox?
You know, I'll tell you, it is one of the great honors of my life to be able to serve my country both at the White House and at the United States Mint. But being nominated, then confirmed, and then sworn into that job, and realize that you have stewardship over an organization that has been around since 1792, and was founded by the United States Constitution, you know, that makes you really think about what it means to serve your country. And I'm glad I did it, and would encourage any one of your listeners to consider a stint in public service.
Go ahead, Bill. You'd be good at public service.
No, I would not. So, all right, you're leading the U.S. Mint. You're head of that. You are the 38th person to have that job. I don't know. To me, that is a gigantic honor. And what is, as you start the job, what are you finding to be the very best part about being in this position?
I think there's several. First of all, you know, you're heading up this institution that's been around since 1792. It's had a huge impact on American citizens. Virtually everybody has our product in their pockets. So we affect a great number of people. And being in charge of that organization, you have several responsibilities. One is to make sure there's enough circulating currency to make economic transactions easy to do. And, that's a primary job. But you also have some secondary jobs that have equal importance. One is that we have a retail business. We make coins for collectors, and you want to be able to make sure that that business is profitable and successful and the taxpayers don't subsidize it. And then you're also leading a institution that has 2,000 employees, including Fort Knox, and those employees deserve, as public servants, they deserve respect and being given an important responsibility to do and the resources to be able to do their jobs well. And then finally, you have an impact on the nation. One of our other products that we had was precious metal bullion. And little did I know when I took the reins in 2006 that there'd be a financial crisis in 2008. And during a financial crisis, when you have that much instability, people want to diversify very quickly. And they like to diversify usually in precious metals like gold, silver, and platinum, of which the United States Mint makes bullion coins. And we saw production go up 700% under my tenure.
Does the U.S. have a reserve of gold, Ed, or do you have to go out and buy that on the market? And if you do have a reserve, how much reserve do you have?
I could answer the last part of that question for you, but I have to kill you, which would be a little hard to do over
the phone. No, go ahead.
A lot of people would like that, Ed. Go for it. Yeah.
Well, there are two answers to your question. One is the country of the United States does have gold reserves. And those are primarily at Fort Knox, although we have significant reserves at our West Point Mint as well as our Denver Mint. And between those three locations comprises about 98% of the gold that the United States has as a country. In addition to that, the United States Mint usually keeps about $2 billion of what we call working stock, and that's up at our West Point facility. And that's the gold that we melt down and make into 1 ounce gold bullion coins. And so on hand, we typically have about $2 billion. It's a really cool room. When you walk in, it is stacked with gold bricks. From floor to ceiling, and there's not too many places you can walk into and immediately see $2 billion right in front of your eyes. And West Point Mint's one of those places.
And are there any field trips allowed?
We have allowed some members of the press to view our working stock of gold as recently as last year. After I left the Mint, there was a big push to invite members of the media to go in and see it just so that they can confirm that it's there.
Well, go ahead, George.
Did you work with the Secret Service on forgery, too? I noticed the new $100 bill is very complex and...
That's the Bureau of Engraving, isn't it?
Yes. So
I'm sorry about George.
He wanted to kill me a minute ago.
That's true.
Yes. There's two parts to our currency. One is coin, which the United States Mint is responsible for, and that was the first part of government that minted money. And then the second, which grew over time, was the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which started off doing stamps and government certificates and eventually got into the business of making bills. Between the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and the United States Mint, we comprise both the paper and the coin component of circulating currency.
We're talking to Ed Moy, who used to be the 38th director of the U.S. Mint, and if you have a question for him, well, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 1-877-933-2484. All right, Ed, I've got a couple of questions before we get to the serious subjects.
Sure.
And the first one I have is, okay, we as taxpayers spend about, what, is about $86 million a year making pennies?
That's right. I think, that's a very close number.
Okay, so it costs a couple of cents to make a penny? That's the sort of strategy?
Yeah. How that business model works is when we make circulating coins, when commercial banks order rolls, The Federal Reserve satisfies that order, and when the Federal Reserve's inventories go down, they order coins from the mint. They pay a face value for those coins. So on a penny, as you said, a penny costs about 2.4 cents to make. That's the metal cost and the cost and the manufacturing cost from the mint. And the Federal Reserve pays us 1 cent for it. So 1.4 cents is subsidized by the taxpayers. And when you make about 6 billion pennies, like they did last year, you get to about $80 million of subsidies. At the same time, it takes about 10 cents to make a quarter, and we get paid 25 cents for a quarter, and so that's a 15-cent profit. And when you make about 3 billion quarters, all that surplus more than offsets the cost of making a penny. But still, you lose about $80 million a year making pennies.
Okay, now we've become a culture and a society of recycling. We always have that idea now on our brain. I wonder how much money is in penny jars in people's homes, mm-hmm. and could we be more deliberate in saying 2-3 times a year you empty your penny dish and you take it to the bank and you get those pennies back in circulation?
Absolutely. And if more Americans did that, that would have a impact on reducing the deficit that's accumulated each year.
Bill okay. Arnold, true patriot. Well, it's a penny idea.
Ryan,
I like it.
Get a patent on that idea. I want to make sure that was publicly patented.
Writing it down.
There
yeah.
you go. We're talking to Ed Moy from the U.S. Mint, and we are going to just take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have lots more. You're listening to Connecting Faith on My Faith Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
As parents, you always want to know what or whom is influencing your children. While most of us have a good handle on this in the real world, did you ever think about who could be influencing your child online? Zabra is a new way for you to protect and monitor your kids' influences while on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Zabra works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to alert you to potentially harmful conversations on social media. For more information, visit Zabra.com. That's Zabra.com to get started today.
How would you describe Faith Radio?
It's inspiring.
It really challenges me.
It gives me that nudge I need in the right direction.
We'd be honored to hear why you listen and why you'd recommend Faith Radio to friends and loved ones. It's simple to share your story. Just call our Faith Line and leave a message with your story. The number is 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. Then press 2 for the Faith Line. And thank you for sharing your story on the Faith Radio Faith Line.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith, 1216. Don't even know what the temperature is. It's cold.
Cold.
Let's just say cold. Is it even above zero right now? What is
I think
the
it is, Bill. It's about 5 degrees.
Okay, good, good. We are talking to Ed Moy today. This is Bill Arnold and George Fraser from Real Recovery. We are at 5 o'clock on Sunday, so we are filling in today for Neil, who I think just got back from the Olympics. Did he not win the gold medal in something, George?
I know he's ski jump for Norway.
Ski jump for Norway, yeah. See, I know so little about Neil.
Well, he's not, you know, he doesn't talk about himself a lot.
He's got a lot of humility.
He does.
Yeah. And our guest on the line, Ed Moy, has the same amount of humility, and he had a very big job, 38th director of the U.S. Mint, appointed by George Bush, and he was in charge of producing that and being in charge of the Fort Knox.
Well, and he liked your penny idea, Bill.
And he liked my penny idea. So, Ed, let's just jump back into it. My first question that I want to ask you about is being a Christian in Washington, D.C., taking your faith and living with the environment that you're in.
Yes. My initial observation, it should be an encouragement to your listeners, is that there are a lot of Christians in Washington, D.C., and a fair amount of them are very serious about their faith and are working toward integrating their faith in what they do, which includes public policy and politics. And so there are a number of us that quickly gathered for support and encouragement, accountability, as well as study of the Word. And so the faith community is very alive in Washington. So I'd say that's very good and positive news. I think the difficult part is so much of the infrastructure of Washington naturally predisposes itself against issues of faith, and so it's a definite uphill climb. And for that, if you know any Christians in public service, you ought to be praying for them because they need it.
We don't do that enough, do we? Praying for Christians in leadership, Christians in...
Yep. It's really, really a hard area because once you become known as Christian, you become a target of the enemy, and you need all the support and help that you can.
Mm-hmm. And you found, how did you find it personally?
Personally, you know, first of all, it was such a blessing to be able to serve in Washington in these leadership positions. I found that several times I'd refer back to how Joseph or Daniel or Nehemiah would have handled a situation in that you're given great responsibility. And so, you know, so from that perspective, I learned a lot in my walk on how to be more faithful and how to integrate my faith into the decisions that I would make on a day-to-day basis. I also found it very challenging because that integration didn't always go smoothly. What was very helpful was having a number of believers around me that would not only support me, be sounding boards for me, but also hold me accountable to make sure that I wouldn't be compromising my faith in any way in serving in these high positions.
Is there a conflict? For me as a believer, Ed, I get conflicted, and kind of a long question here, but I think it'll make some sense. And you're working for the government, and as a Christian, sometimes the government can be part of the problem for me. Here's what I mean by that. Take health care, for instance. I would like every kid, every poor person to have health care in this country. I think it's a great idea. But having the government implement that obviously hasn't worked real well. So there's kind of conflicts in there, aren't there, between working with the government and being a Christian and wanting, you know, Christian values, but can the government provide those?
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, the government has a necessary role. You know, for example, national security. I can't protect the country via my home protection. I have to defer to the government to be able to do that. But there are other things that I think there's honest people would have a debate on, in that there are multiple ways of solving a problem, and some of those ways don't include government. And so I think that you know you're exactly right. You know, government solutions tend to be less effective in some areas. In healthcare, the current implementation of the Affordable Care Act is one of them. But there are other areas where government is totally appropriate. For example, in solving the Somali pirate situation and saving Captain Phillips. That was done by the military, which is part of the government, and in those ways, government can be very effective.
That's a great answer. It was a good movie, too.
I didn't see the movie.
It's excellent.
I want to see it now. So it must have extra significance for you, Ed, to think that the money is printed with In God We Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were in position there, was there opposition to that continuing to be the case, that In God We Trust would stay on the money? And what kind of what did you encounter regarding that?
Yeah, so you know, virtually every year there'd be a very small, and this is a small minority that would come from more of an atheistic perspective and want to excise In God We Trust off our money. And, you know, but it was never a big movement, and I, as Mint Director, was never under any pressure to remove that. Now, on the other hand, there was a situation where, and you continue to see it in some of these Internet postings, where people have been thinking that In God We Trust is already off the currency, and using the new dollar coin as one way to say that God is being forced out of the public square. And that controversy actually happened when I was Mint Director, and I can emphatically say that the law requires us to put In God We Trust on our money. and all the coins that have been made by the United States Mint, including up to recently, have In God We Trust on those coins. The notion that we've removed that or that God is no longer part of that is not true. Now, saying that, there was an interesting controversy in 1907 when In God We Trust had been put on our currency as an option. Congress voted to give the Secretary of the Treasury and the Mint Director the option of putting it on our coins since the Civil War. And it's been on straight through until 1907. Teddy Roosevelt pretty much made an argument of saying, listen, there's part of Scripture that says, you can't worship both God and money at the same time. And so it's a bit of a sacrilege to have In God We Trust on our money. And so I'm going to remove it on the new $20 gold coin that was coming out in 1907. Well, there was immediate outcry of American citizens, and they wrote in, and that ended up forcing Congress to pass legislation mandating, instead of giving the option, to put In God We Trust on all the coins.
Obviously, George and I did not pay attention in history class. This is all very fascinating and new information to me. Did you know any of this, George?
Just I'm reading Kern Goodwin's book about Taft and Roosevelt, and that wasn't in there. So that is interesting.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ed Moy, who is the former director of the U.S. Mint, living in Seattle. And Ed, I was just kind of wondering how much money is currently in circulation in the country, in the U.S.
Gosh, that is a really good question.
Thank you. Make a note that Bill Arnold asked it.
Because
we're not
all
keeping
I know
score
is the
or
money
anything.
That we end up making is replacement. So coins get hurt in a car accident, or they get worn so that the vending machines can't use them anymore. And so the coins that the United States ends up making generally supplement the coins that we're taking out of circulation.
Okay.
Plus, if there are more economic activity that requires more currency, both the Mint and the Bureau of Engraving make additions. But the actual number of, the dollar amount of all the coin and bills that are out there, that's a really good question. I don't know that off the top of my head, but I would suspect that it would at least be in the $100 billion range.
Okay, it was always my thought or my understanding that there needed to be enough gold at Fort Knox, maybe I learned this in fourth grade, that would be able to back the amount of currency that was in circulation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth to that, or is that a wives' tale?
There is truth to that, although that's not true anymore. When our country was first founded, our coins actually had precious metal in them that equaled the face value. So a quarter would have 25 cents worth of silver, a $20 gold piece would have $20 worth of gold in it. And so there was a precious metal standard that existed among all countries' currencies 300 years ago. Over time, and here in the United States, beginning in 1933, we started going off that gold standard. And so in 1933, Roosevelt was confronted with the situation where our economy was still suffering from the Great Depression, and austerity seemed not to have improved the economy quickly enough. And so Roosevelt's theory was we need to provide more stimulus. So there are certainly certain parallels to what's going on in our country today. And in the end, what Roosevelt was limited by was all the money that he had gold for had already been printed. And so he did something controversial in 1933 when he became president. He issued an executive order forcing all Americans to turn in their gold coins. And in exchange for, say, for example, a $20 gold coin, the government would give them a $20 bill. Well, overnight, Roosevelt had a huge a reserve of gold coins now that he could print more money off of. And from that, that's how he got the stimulus money that you could argue might have moved our economy out of the Depression, or you could also argue that the industrial output during World War II was what got us out of the Depression. And so, but over time, and it was confirmed in the mid-70s that the United States finally went off the gold standard, and now what we're doing is what's commonly known as fiat currency.
Excellent.
Fiat is the government telling you that it ought to be worth something, and beginning in the 70s, the government said there's no more gold backing these dollars, but the government is ordering everybody to accept the dollar bill as worth being worth $1.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith, everyone. It's 12:31. Glad you're joining us on your lunch hour today. Bill Arnolds and George Fraser from Real Recovery at 5 o'clock on Sunday, sitting in today for Neil Stavem with Ryan Thomas on the board, doing a stellar job as always. We have as guest today Ed Moy. He was the 38th director of the U.S. Mint from 2006 to 2011. Dedicated, committed Christian and patriot. And boy, I tell you, that's a tall job he had. And when we last left off, we were absolutely willing to take callers. If you have questions for Ed, give us a call at 1-877-933-2484. And George, let's jump back into the conversation now, because gold surged under, has surged in the last year by what percentage, Ed?
Well, you know, it depends on where you pick the starting point, but gold's gone up roughly from about $1,200 to today. It broke $1,340.
So, as an investment vehicle, it's obviously incredibly interesting to people to have that be part of their portfolio. Why is it so popular and attractive right now?
Well, for several reasons. The first is, in anybody's portfolio, regardless of what's going on, I am a balanced portfolio advocate. And so what you want is a nice mixture between your cash, stocks, bonds, savings, and the other asset category is called tangible assets, your house, a car, et cetera. And a key part of the tangible assets ought to be gold. And here's the reason why. This gets to the second reason. The price of gold typically goes opposite directions of the value of the dollar. So if the value of the dollar goes down through inflation or through economic crisis, the value of gold normally goes up. And you want gold as an insurance policy on all your other paper assets, which are the vast majority of what your investments are going to be. You want an insurance policy to hedge against the value of the dollar and how it's going to impact those paper investments. And then third, gold can be speculative, meaning you can play the volatility. And right now, given the shakiness of the U.S. economy, the growing crisis in Ukraine, creating world instability, those things have caused investors to rush toward gold, and that's why you've seen the price go up so much over the last couple of weeks.
Well, we're looking at gold at $1,342 an ounce, and I believe when Nixon was president, Ed, it was $35 an ounce. Is that
that's
fair?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So we've seen quite a rise there, and so we want to balance out our portfolios and have something there. What I wonder is, what happens in a deflationary environment? What would happen to our price of gold?
Well, a deflationary environment, two things would happen. One is, as prices end up going down, they'll slow things down to the point where then superinflation's going to take place. So that's why deflation is so bad for an economy. And during a situation like that, gold then provides an immense amount of stability into that portfolio. And here's the other reason why you want some gold in your portfolio. I have friends that work for Lehman Brothers, and when Lehman Brothers went belly up, their stock went from whatever it was to zero overnight, which could happen. And if you owned Greek bonds or et cetera, the same thing would have happened to you. You would have had a huge loss. At the same time, you know, gold is at 1340. Gold may go down and gold may go up. But I'll tell you one thing, gold will never be worth zero. And so with that part of your portfolio, having relative stability allows you to take risk in other parts of your portfolio.
And when you talk about gold being part of your portfolio, how does that happen? I mean, do you bring gold bullion into your house? I mean, I can't find my car keys half the time. I can see myself walking around going, "Where is that gold bullion?"
I'll hold on to it for you guys. Oh,
thank you so much.
Make that investment.
But the whole idea seems a little intimidating if you've not invested in gold before, to think, "All right, where am I going to stick this gold?"
Yes.
Explain what that's like to listeners.
The vast majority of your listeners, when they invest in gold, they will likely invest in government-made bullion coins. And the reason why is when the United States Mint makes a gold bullion coin, the United States Mint is guaranteeing, giving a government guarantee, that that 1 ounce gold coin has exactly 1 ounce of gold in it. It's pure. It weighs exactly the way it's supposed to. And if it doesn't, you can always trade it in for one that does. And so with that guarantee, there's a lot of recognition between people who trade in gold that there's a certain quality standardization in that gold bullion coin. And so you would rather do that than, say, for example, buy a gold bar. Gold bars are made by private companies. You don't know if they coated that gold with have a lead core in the middle of it, or somebody shaved off some of that gold. So all those, you got all those issues if you buy bars, but you don't have those issues when you buy coins. Where you store them? People typically would store part of their gold portfolio at home so they have ready access to it, but they would also put it in a safety deposit box, and then people who have large amounts of gold would find a secure depository, and those exist in every major city to put that gold in.
Ed, why would I want to buy the physical gold rather than a gold stock that pays a dividend or an ETF or, you know, yep, or mutual fund? What would be the thoughts there?
Well, so what you mentioned, gold stocks, ETFs, futures contracts, shorting the price of gold, all those all have their place in an investment portfolio, but they are not a substitute for physical gold. So, for example, when my mom, who was living in Hong Kong during the Japanese takeover, and she ran out of her house to save her life, she had a bracelet of 10 American gold coins around it. She had a number of American gold coins in a necklace, and she was able to trade on that to keep her family alive and thriving during a period of crisis. Try doing that with an ETF certificate. Believe me, a grocery store is not going
to
handle that for you. So ETFs certainly have their place, but they're not a substitute for physical gold. If you're trying to diversify your portfolio, physical gold is one of the things you want to do it with.
So I'm looking at physical gold as just a safety portion of my investment rather than an ETF or a stock, which would be just like buying another stock as a form of investment.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Exactly.
Makes a lot of sense. I really like your point that gold will never go to the value of zero. That's a great selling point.
Yeah, and it's also because gold has industrial uses, too. It's used in electronics and computers, and so you have other demand for gold that helps support its price, whereas with all your paper investments, they're basically dollar-denominated, and it's the full faith and credit of the United States that's backing up that fiat currency. And so, to me, you got to accept it because the government tells you to accept it, but it gives me peace of mind to have a part of my portfolio that has independent value.
Well, and you were in the thick of this in Washington. You know, we turned on the printing presses here, and that's coming to an end, and so we really don't know what's going to happen, and it would be nice to have a part of my portfolio that I can rest on, that I know is always going to be there.
Right, right. And, you know, really, and that's the concern is when the Federal Reserve basically prints $4.4 trillion extra dollars to stimulate the economy, and the economy is not that stimulated from all of that, the Federal Reserve now is cutting back because the program is not having the desired impact. Well, the problem is no one's ever unwound a $4.4 trillion program before, and in order to do that successfully, the U.S. economy has to grow between 3 and 4%. If it grows less, we have deflationary pressure, as you guys just mentioned, and if it grows more, you have inflationary pressure. And so either way causes the dollar, the value of the dollar to go down, which is good for gold because gold prices will go up.
Now, Ed, you were right at the center of everything. How close were we to going over the edge?
You know, the history books are still trying to figure all that out. But I will tell you, being in the middle of that crisis, first of all, the emotional impact when you're sitting in these meetings, we thought the end of the world was coming. And I think now, as you see the numbers come out, the worldwide credit system, the financial system, et cetera, was coming to a collapse. And so something needed to be done. At the same time, was what was done the best thing that could have been done? I think the jury is coming out saying it may have solved one problem, but it may have created several others that we're dealing with today.
Was it a godsend to have the head of the Federal Reserve, a man whose specialty was the Great Depression?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Chairman Bernanke, when he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, was a fellow White House staffer with me. And when we would attend senior staff meetings together every morning, he would, you know, give his economic reports and stuff like that. So I got to know him, you know, a little bit through that. And I come to have great respect for Chairman Bernanke. I think he was put in a really awkward spot when Congress and the president, after the crisis, and then they had to figure out how to stimulate the economy, when both the president, beginning in 2008, beginning in 2012, had to figure out what the best way, 8 and 12, had to figure out the best way to stimulate the economy, and they and Congress couldn't come to an agreement, Ben Bernanke had to come up with this alternative. And so in a way, he was acting as a patriot, but he's also being now painted as an enabler of some of the Washington dysfunction.
But at that point, just keeping it going was the number one issue, wasn't it?
That's correct, and he did keep it going.
We are talking to Ed Moy today. He was the 38th director of the U.S. Mint, and we're going to go to break in just a minute here, Ed. But I have a question, because the selection of coins when you were in leadership, I mean, some of the coins that didn't work really well, like the Sacagawea dollar, or, I mean, was the Susan B. Anthony, was that considered a success or a failure? And what about what some of the Europeans do, like when I'm in Europe and they've got the two dollar coin? I think that's one of the best coins out there, really. I just love a $2 coin. Has that ever been discussed, or was that ever on the table for attempting to get that into the U.S. currency?
It's being discussed now, because that type of currency reform could save taxpayers $500 to $700 million a year in printing costs. And we can talk a little bit more about that when we come back from break. But the United States lags behind every other developed country as far as having a logical grouping of their currency.
Well, great. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll pick up that conversation. And we're also going to ask Ed about how he became a Christian. I think that's a great way to end today's show. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Sitting in today for Neil Staven, Bill Arnold, and George Fraser from Real Recovery. Glad you're aboard. It's 12:44.
I like you.
No, I like you.
No, I really like you.
I liked you first.
As you can see at Faith Radio, we really like our friends on Facebook.
And we hope to connect with you there soon.
Find us when you search My Faith Radio on Facebook.
Or just browse to Facebook.com/MyFaithRadio.
It's connecting faith to your everyday life
right in your Facebook newsfeed.
We look forward to your like.
My Faith Radio on Facebook.
Are you struggling to keep up with your fitness plans for the new year? We want to help. Join us for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge as Susie Larson leads you down a six-week journey of faith and fitness. During these next few weeks, we'll focus on physical and spiritual steps to a healthier life as you commit to live fit. Sign up for free at myfaithradio.com. We start March 3rd. It's not too late to sign up for Commit to Live Fit 40-Day Challenge.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. It is 12:46. Hope you're enjoying your lunch. Thank you for spending your time with us. This is Bill Arnold with George Fraser, and we are sitting in for Neil today. We have Ed Moy with us today. He was the 38th director of U.S. Mint, and we are talking about gold today. We're talking about money in the economy, and we're going to talk a little bit, hopefully, about Ed's personal faith journey towards the end. But Ed, when we last left off, and it was a cliffhanger, we were talking about coin selection and the discussions that have been made about bringing a new currency into the system and trying to reduce some of the load on taxpayers.
Yes. So most developed countries have gone this route. They have gotten rid of their lowest denomination coin, which the equivalent here in the U.S. would be the penny. They've gone to a high denomination coin, like the dollar coin, and then they've gotten rid of their lowest denomination bill. So you get rid of the $1 bill. And just to show you how the economics work, if you got rid of the penny, you would save about $80 million of overage that it costs to make a penny versus what the Federal Reserve and banks pay us for that penny. And then when you get to a dollar coin, you make money on a dollar coin because it takes about 20 cents to make that dollar coin, and you're basically selling it to banks for a dollar. And so the profit margin is pretty large on that. And then third, because a dollar coin lasts about 40 years into circulation, and a bill typically lasts anywhere from 12 months to about 36 months in regular circulation, the dollar coin costs 20 cents to make, the bill costs 4 cents to make. Do the math, and you can save $500 million a year on printing costs. And that without having to raise a tax or to cut a program. And so there's given our current budget deficit situation, there's much more interest in Congress to do something about currency reform.
Okay. Now, Ed, that would save $500 million in printing and coinage costs. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about rounding up, how much the hidden tax would be for the consumer, because businesses are going to round up, not down. Any studies on that?
Typically, in countries that have done this change, like New Zealand, Australia, the European Union, Canada, all those countries, when they've done this and gotten rid of the lowest denomination, businesses are supposed to round to the nearest 5 cents. Most businesses end up rounding up. So you get a one-time hit on inflation, but then people get used to that in the outgoing years and it becomes much less of an issue. One question to ask is an inflationary hit right now a good thing for our country to go through given our weak economy? It's probably not the best time.
Interesting.
How does, Ed, the debt issue that's currently in our country, what are you seeing for our future economically and spiritually?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, first of all, we wouldn't have debt if government would live within its means. And the problem is government programs have expanded so much, and this is mostly in the mandatory side, Social Security, health care for the elderly and for the poor, some of our income support programs like welfare. When you add all that stuff up, there's not enough tax dollars that come in just to pay for those, even if you got rid of the all the money we spent on defense and all the money that we spend on supporting the rest of the government, you still couldn't balance the budget. And so there, to me, a accountability issue before the Lord as a country in making sure that we have a balanced budget. I mean, take a look at how Joseph managed the 7 years of good crops and then 7 years of famine. He had a plan in place to balance all that stuff out. There's no plan in place right now to balance what's going on in our deficit situation. It's very sad as a country, and I grieve for future generations that are going to be handcuffed because of this huge amount of debt that we have.
Amen.
Ed, yep. I'm fascinated hearing about the story about your mother and how she used her bracelet as leverage to keep things going. And so if you could share a little bit about how you just came to faith in Christ.
Yep.
And the influence she may or may not have had on your life.
Well, yeah, I'm pleased to report that she has always been reluctant to consider the Lordship of Christ until 2 weeks before she passed. And she had a conversion experience. I saw it in her face when I saw her in the hospice unit. And it just lifts my spirits to know that I will see her in heaven one day. But, you know, to go back to the original question that you asked, you know, both my parents, my dad comes from mainland China. My mom comes from Hong Kong. My dad had no spiritual upbringing. My mom was born in a Christian family. But it was very unclear as to whether or not she had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So in a typical Chinese family, I grew up with the father doing the lead, and my dad, having no spiritual background at all, didn't know much about faith. And I was really only exposed to it when I started going to college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And there, my eyes were really opened. I fell in with a group of Christians who were smart, who were attractive, who were fun to be with, who were great athletes. And it just really blew my mind, because the Christians that I knew up until that point were what you would probably stereotype, what the liberal media might stereotype as a typical Christian. And God used those people to challenge me. And by the end of my senior year, I was sitting down with one of my spiritual mentors, and I basically said, the more I study about Christ, the more questions I have. And he looked at me and he said, you know, Ed, you're a finite being trying to understand an infinite being. There's, of course, going to be some questions. But what you need to do is take a leap of faith. And that night I prayed the sinner's prayer. And interestingly enough, the next day when I was reading Scripture was not, which it had up until that point, been an interesting book that had, you know, black and white words on a page. And the next day after I prayed that prayer, Scripture seemed alive to me. And that's when I knew that Jesus was who he said he was, and he was living in my heart.
Ed, how do you stay sharp out in a secular world? A business guy, you've got a lot of things going on all the time that can take all of your attention. How do you stay focused on Jesus?
Mm-hmm. Several things. One is, of course, the personal disciplines. But practically speaking, I need a group of guys around me who know me, who can hold me accountable, who can challenge me and ask me the tough questions. And that has been critical in my walk with Christ. And one of the difficult things for me is it became very clear to me after I became a believer that my friends came up to me and said, okay, what are you going to do for full-time ministry? You know, are you going to go into full-time ministry? I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, I want you to consider being a pastor or a missionary or a parachurch worker. And I felt that God had wired me for business and for politics and for changing culture. And they looked at me and they said, Ed, you know, that's not full-time ministry. And further, it's really tough to be a Christian in those three areas. Well, I agree with the last part. It's really tough to be a Christian in those three areas, but full-time ministry is whatever God calls you to, and you do it to his glory. And I've chosen those last three areas to focus my life on.
I agree with you 100%. Bill and I do a lot of work with the Salvation Army Treatment Center here in Minneapolis. And when our guys graduate, getting them a job can be very difficult because of their past and because of the economy. And I think one of the most overlooked ministries is guys who help people get a job. What a great ministry that is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're out there battling everybody all day, and it is a ministry. And I think a lot of the other ministries overlook that because they don't think of it as a ministry. But I don't think there's anything you can do better for somebody than help them get a job. And you've done that your whole career. I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, from my perspective, throughout all of Scripture, God tells us to serve Him in all spheres of life. And that's where, you know, getting back to the original question of public service that we were talking about earlier in this interview, the, you know, Scripture has abundant examples from Joseph and Daniel and Nehemiah and David and how they all struggled, but they weren't, quote, in full-time Christian ministry in our traditional sense today, but they were all in full-time Christian ministry in a biblical sense.
Well, think about all the poor guys who went into the administration after the crash and had to unload all their stocks at the low point just to go work for a government position. You know, that's something, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Although, you know, I will say one thing about working as Mint director. My dad, who had always been disappointed that I would be willing to give up you know, stock in order to go public service, when I told him about the Mint, he went, "Ah, yeah, finally, my son." He accepted a job where he's going to make a lot of money. I didn't have the heart to tell him none of it was mine.
Oh, that's great.
Any stories that you can share on the way out? We've got just 90 seconds left from your days in the Bush administration in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
A quick one?
You know, I try to keep those very quiet and confidential,
okay.
for, you know, for obvious reasons.
Oh, sure.
But I will say that one of my thrills working in the White House, I was there for 5.5 years, is I worked directly for President Bush. And I can attest that I've had hundreds of meetings with him in the Oval Office and with Vice President Cheney and with Chief of Staff Andy Card at the time, and I can tell you that the president's faith is genuine, and I've seen him meet with people, and when they bring up something that's difficult that they're going through in their lives, for him just to pause the meeting and ask if he could pray for them and then have an extemporary prayer for them, that's the type of guy that President Bush was. So regardless of whether what you thought of the man's policies, this man was a devout follower of Christ who wanted to glorify God in everything he did, including the personal relationships that he developed at the White House.
Love it. George and me do not seek approval, but has this been the best interview you've ever done?
It's great.
No, I'm asking Ed. Not asking you.
That's the answer for him.
Ed's website is edmoy.com. Fascinating interview today. Ed, thank you so much for being part of Connecting Faith.
Bill and George, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much.
And you're still not going to get a free sample.
I get that. I'm going to hold that against you. A little resentment.
All right.
Anyway, thank you for listening to Connecting Faith. Neil will be back tomorrow, I believe. On behalf of Ryan Thomas, this has been Bill Arnold with George Fraser. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.